With that having been said, that brief introduction, I'd like to welcome John DeNugent and Margaret Huffstickler.
Good evening, Ed, Mike.
How you doing tonight, John?
Just fine, thank you.
Good evening, everyone.
Margaret, welcome aboard. This is your first appearance here on this program, and I certainly hope it won't be the last.
Thanks, me too.
Yeah, we're going to be talking, as I told the audience here the other evening. I don't know if you heard me or not, but I told we were going to be talking about someone who is virtually the meanest man in the world, if we're to believe the mass media in America and around the world. And, of course, we're talking about Adolf Hitler, but we're not talking about Hitler the man, per se. We all know he's presented as a ranting, raving, screaming, gnawing figure, this kind of a petulant, scheming, soulless being who's driven solely by power. But what a lot of people don't know about Hitler, everybody knows about the Holocaust, whether you believe in the details of that controversial period in history or not. Everybody has heard about that. But what a lot of people don't know about are the economic policies that Adolf Hitler carried out when he came to power in Germany in 1933. Economic powers or economic policies that directly challenged the international bankers who circulate in the sphere of the Rothschild family and their satellites in the United States and around the world, the very people who control the American economic system, obviously, through the Federal Reserve System. And, you know, most of the listeners to RBN are very familiar, obviously, with the reality of the Federal Reserve and what it's all about and how it really is a privately owned money monopoly that that impacts upon our world and has done so since 1913. The Federal Reserve, of course, was set up to basically codify codifying the economic power of the Rothschilds and their allies, the international banking community. Adolf Hitler took those people on when he came to power. That's what we're going to talk about when we come back from the break. We have John DeNugent and Margaret Huffstickler, two people who can tell you the truth. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. This is Michael Collins Pfeiffer coming to you from Washington, very, very cold Washington, D.C. here tonight, with two very special guests, John DeNugent and Margaret Huffstickler. Is about history, but it's also history as news or news as history because, as you all know, you can't turn on the television or the radio, the mainstream mass media, or open up a magazine or go into a bookstore or even a daily newspaper without hearing about Adolf Hitler and, of course, the Holocaust. Well, we're not talking about the Holocaust here tonight. But we are talking about something that is very newsy because we're going to present some information here about some economic policies carried out by Adolf Hitler that really help us understand why we had World War II, why World War II was really fought. With that having been said, I'd just like to invite John and Margaret to launch into what I promise you is going to be a very interesting and fact-filled analysis here this evening, and later we'll take some calls as we have the time. So, John and Margaret, I'll let you take the floor here.
Okay, sure, thanks. The first thing, even before I talk about these economic policies, is just a general theory of how one must deal with World War II, not to mention the Holocaust, as the big lie, and how one deals with the big lie, because you'll notice that a lot of people are willing to, of course, by now, a whole lot of people are willing to reject the Holocaust because it's been proven it doesn't exist. They're willing to accept even that Hitler didn't start the war. But they will not go that extra distance to say, well, who was he really? You know, and why is he being kept from us? Why do they find it so very important to put a lock on that door and say, don't come near here? You know, that is, nobody even dares to do it because if they do, they'll be called a neo-Nazi. Why does he need to be protected like that? You know, it's obvious that we're not supposed to look there. And just as a general principle, first I want to say the big lie is a very special kind of lie. Some people think that they're being very sophisticated to say, well, they didn't do the Holocaust and they didn't do World War II, but Hitler was a thug and the Germans were evil and, you know, we don't want to minimize that. they're not paying attention to the fact that the purpose of the big lie is to make such a huge lie that you can do away with 90% of the lie and you will still have the big lie. So you can say, there was no Holocaust, there was no this, there was no that. But if you leave any bit of their lie in place, it's still a big lie. And in fact, if you don't even go farther than that, past neutral, like you say, okay, well, it's the Germans didn't do the Holocaust, so you get to neutral there. But they were probably bad, and the truth is halfway in between. No, that's not the way it is. The way it is the truth is way over on the other side, because there was a Holocaust. There was a Holocaust of 60 million people or so in World War II, and somebody committed that. So always when you're dealing with the big lie, it seems, you are dealing with a lie to cover up a crime, and the crime is even bigger than they can make the lie. So when they talk about the Holocaust, they're covering up their own crime, 60 million dead. And you'll notice in the Nuremberg trials, so many accusations, if you start reading about atrocities after the war done by the Allies and the East Europeans, they are just like the things you read about that Germany was accused of after the war. They are accusing them of their own crimes, which is a Marxian dictum, to accuse your enemy of the crimes that you yourself do. So, with that in mind, you always have to go much farther than you think, and it's much more sophisticated not to try to take the middle ground, but to go and look why they're making this big lie. So in the case of Hitler, there's a very, very important reason why they don't want you to look in that door, which is that Hitler was showing people the way out of what many, many people now realize we want out of, which is the bankers' clutches. Hitler had begun, partly by necessity, a barter system with many different countries of the world. And what that did was it meant that Germany became the country with the best living standard in the world. Not only that, but it was extended to all the classes. It was not just the rich people were rich, but everyone in Germany had a good living standard. That's because they didn't have to skim off a whole bunch of their money and give it to the bankers. Because in normal international trade, you go through the bankers and you pay them every step of the way. But once you start dealing with barter and you bypass the bankers, you keep it. So the nail in the coffin of the World War bankers, which they saw coming if they did not immediately start the war, was in 1938. Hitler sent his economic minister, Walter Funk, to Eastern Europe to make deals with Bulgaria, Hungary, Yugoslavia, in order to arrange very favorable economic deals with them. He was pulling them into his zone of influence, which was going to be very profitable for all sides, in which they would be bypassing the bankers. Well, that was bad enough, and the bankers of the City of London, which I think most people know about those people, were ready. They were inured to that. They could have stood that. But then they found out that Hitler had made a deal with Mexico for oil, and it was a barter deal, but the assumed price of the oil that it was being bartered for was much lower than Mexico gave to the bankers. They saw their death knell, because Walter Funk was also about to go to South America, go through Central and South America making similar deals. That means the bankers would have been out of a job. They would have been out of their sinecure, where they just skimmed money off of work everybody else did. So it was do or die at that point. And that is the point at which Joaquin Bochaca says the non-Jewish bankers threw in their lot with the Jewish bankers, those bankers in England who had been resisting the idea of starting another world war.
It's kind of interesting, Margaret, excuse me, it's interesting to point out that there are a lot of people to this day who believe that Hitler was actually a tool of the international bankers, and they point out that Hitler had received support from large financial interests in Germany and in the United States in the early years of his regime. But in fact, as you have pointed out very effectively and very skillfully here in just the last few minutes, Adolf Hitler was carrying out economic policies once he became the leader of Germany that actually were running counter to these international bankers and their interests.
That's right. Of course, people contribute money to campaigns for many, many different reasons, and they're fairly complex. But one of the key things is you can see that if they expected Adolf Hitler to cooperate with them in return, he did not do it. That's rather like John Kennedy and the Mafia. I think they had an idea that they were going to get some concessions, which they didn't get later. Is that right, Mike?
That's exactly right. Yes, and he and his brother launched the biggest war in organized crime that had ever been seen on American soil. And essentially, what we saw happening here in the United States was a parallel to what you've described happening in Germany and really throughout Europe and the world under the leadership of Adolf Hitler.
That's right. Well, you know, the first inkling I had of this was several years ago. I was reading in a revisionist book by the revisionist historian James Martin, a very great writer. It was a book on economics in Roosevelt's time. And it mentioned that the three outlaw states economically who were not following the path they were supposed to were, of course, Italy, Japan, and Germany. This was way before World War II. The three odd men out were Italy, Germany, and Japan. So,
essentially, they were resisting what people like to refer to here and now as the New World Order.
That's right. The globalist, regime. You know, they required subservience to their requirements.
It's kind of interesting, Margaret and John, that a lot of patriots today say, "Oh, well, Hitler was part of the New World Order because he referred to his regime and his plans for Germany and for Europe as the New Order." But in fact, that New Order was breaking away from what we call the New World Order.
That's right, and there's a very interesting difference in the kind of European Union Hitler envisaged compared to the one there is today, which is that he was very strong on the sovereignty of each country. Because, as you know, he was a strong nationalist, but not just for Germany. He believed that every nation should have it put itself first and protect itself. Just the same as with humans. They all, on a plane, you see the sign to put on your own oxygen mask before you try to help your children.
Exactly.
You have to. Nobody else is going to take care of you the way you will. But the globalists, of course, want us to not think that because they want to get in and grab everything they can.
All right. Very good introduction here tonight, folks. I think you probably learned more about Adolf Hitler than you've ever learned in the last 20 years. All right, stay tuned, and we will take your calls at 800-313-9443. All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. Michael Collins Piper here tonight on this Republic Broadcasting Network. Thanks to the sponsorship of Headache Stay Gone, the all-natural cure for headaches. Check them out on the Internet at headachestaygone.com. We have two very interesting guests tonight. They're interesting people in and of themselves, and they are presenting some information here, which is indeed very, very interesting and presents a whole new light on why we really fought World War II. We already have two callers, and I think we'll probably go ahead and bring them up because I'm eager to hear what the listeners have to say, John and Margaret. So we're going to go to Henry from Connecticut. Henry, welcome aboard.
Hi, hello.
How are you doing?
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, here's a question, a couple of questions. One is I heard her mention about the 6 million Jews. Now, first of all, has it ever been really substantiated that really an exact count that it was 6 million? And then also when they keep talking about Hitler, they never bring up the possible deaths of, you know, maybe some other people, maybe that just, you know, turned against them or whatever. Whenever you hear stuff of World War II, it's always in Europe, when they talk about Europe, it's always Hitler. They never mention about the millions that were killed, much, much more than even if it was 6 million Jews, with Joseph Stalin, and what he did with the Ukraine, what he did with Lithuania, you know, from the Russian communists, who most of them were Jewish. And matter of fact, I don't know, I'm sure you're aware of this, when Hitler did go into Eastern Europe, so a lot of those Eastern Europeans, the Lithuanians, the Lapithians, or Lapithia, people from what do you call it, Latvia, as well as the Ukraine, joined his Waffen-SS division because between the two, it's kind of like a devil in deep blue sea, but they thought National Socialism was at least better than communism.
Well, I would just comment here, Henry, on in regard to this matter of 6 million. That really is neither here nor there, because even if Hitler killed 6 Jews or 6 million, the numbers are irrelevant to the bigger picture as to why what we're discussing here tonight, as to why the international bankers were so hell-bent on getting a war hyped up against Hitler, and that's precisely what did happen. So, Margaret and John, if you want to comment on that, on Henry's questions, go ahead. Hello?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, there we go, Margaret. I thought
okay,
we lost
good.
You for a moment.
Okay,
yeah,
I would
there.
Say,
okay.
Are you still there, caller?
Yes, I'm here. Go ahead.
Okay. I think the number might be closer to 70,000 rather than 6 million by if you go by
what?
Actual records.
What did you say? 70? Give the number again. I didn't hear.
70,000 Jews perhaps died in the camps during the war.
Well, I think it might have been more than that.
I think about 350,000 of everybody, or something over 300,000. But
okay.
The majority were not Jews who were in the camps. So anyway, it's somewhere below 300,000. I think we can be pretty certain, because they took they had very careful records in Germany. But that's not what we're talking about. But just since
right. I want to get to the economic. I wanted to ask about that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Hitler also made the Volkswagen, but could it possibly be the people who, similar to Hitler, was something like Saddam Hussein, because even though he may not have been a great, an angel, he turned that country around like Saddam did with Iraq. As a matter of fact, I heard Iraq, the only Arab country that had Playboy on the shelf, as well as women allowed to vote and a couple other things. And
yes,
possibly,
and they had this in common, that they had an incredibly high standard of living in Iraq,
right,
before we started messing with them. We don't seem to like people to have a high standard of living, except for ourselves.
Right, except for Israel, right, with solar energy and everything. But also the fact that even though he may have used the bankers at the beginning, because even though Germany had all those brains and genius and ideas, because Germany was broken by Rothschild and them after World War One, he might have used them to help, finance to get him into power, and it turned against him, like Saddam did when we supported and backed him, and then all of a sudden he's a bad guy, and we got to do something about him. And isn't that a similar thing between Saddam and Hitler in that way?
Yes, I think that's very true, and that's one of the reasons it's really important to notice, and not to stop with the Holocaust, but just to really go down in and see, why are they demonized? Why did they demonize the Germans, and why did they say they were in a police state run by Hitler? Well, it's the same thing as Saddam. It's the same excuse. It's always the same excuse. If you can't say that there's some other good reason to invade them, well, at least they're horrible dictators and they're stomping on their own people, even if the people would rather you stayed the hell away. Or in the case of Germany, if the people are very happy, and probably the happiest they've ever been, because that is one common theme you'll find with people who visited Germany during the Third Reich. The people are happy. Why shouldn't they be? They actually got paid for their labor, unlike the people in the United States today. First of all, there aren't jobs for many people. Second of all, many, many people work for wages that are far less than they should get for the work they do.
Right.
All a lot of people really need to be happy is just reasonable conditions, that they get paid for their work, and then they can do what they want.
All right, we have a break
coming
up here. Henry, feel free to stay aboard with us. This is Michael Collins-Piper here on the Republic Broadcasting Network with John DeNugent and Margaret Huckstickler, talking some very controversial and little-known data from history. Gentlemen, welcome back. Michael Collins Piper here on the Republic Broadcasting Network, coming to you live from Washington, D.C. Our guest here tonight, John DeNugent and Margaret Huffstickler. We do have a caller still aboard with us, Henry from Connecticut.
Yes.
One thing I'd like to mention here in reference to this discussion is that there is a popular myth, and I think Margaret can deconstruct this myth, that Germany's economic rebirth came about as a consequence of Hitler's rearmament of Germany. I have seen even liberal writers such as Alexander Coburn actually take issue with this. Margaret, could you comment on that?
Yes, that is an important point because it's so universal. People say, oh, sure, his economy did well because he was building up the war machine, and that's how he did that, and that's, et cetera. No, that's how Roosevelt and Winston Churchill got their economies together, because theirs are the economies that needed it. Hitler's economy did not need a war in order to be going great guns. As soon as he started his public works project, the Autobahn and everything, employment was back to more than 100%. They actually had to bring in workers. So they had no need of a war. It was Roosevelt's Great Society had failed already. They were having another depression again in 1938. He's the one who needed a war to perk up his economy. And he and France and England were building up for war, and Hitler was forced to, in order to confront them if necessary, he was forced to build up his forces. And it's very, very clear. All you have to do is look at the economics of it, look at what was spent on what. And his proportion used for a military budget was very small compared to any of the other countries.
Interesting. All right, Henry, got quite a few callers lined up here already, but if you have any last comments, please go ahead.
Yes, one other thing. One of the things also, though, you got to remember, too, is that the armaments was that in Mein Kampf, if you get the Hearst Blackett edition of Mein Kampf, which is supposed to be unedited and unexpurgated, as far as I know, from German to English, he also says he wanted to take back a territory that was lost from Germany in World War I. Of course, he, like George Bush, he probably manipulated it to take over more territory, but the portions of Poland, the portions of Czechoslovakia that originally belonged to Germany originally, he wanted to try to take that back. But I just want to say this, I'll hang up. There was a Jewish person by the name of Lipschitz, I think. It was a woman. She did some research, supposedly with the Holocaust.
That's definitely upset.
Right, but even she says that lampshade stuff with the lampshades and the soap and how they made the soap and the candles and all that stuff's BS, bull crap.
All right, absolutely.
I'll let you go.
Yeah.
Could I comment on what you just said about taking back the territory?
Okay,
first of all, I want to say I didn't see any signs that he was trying to take back more than was taken away. For example, a lot of people don't know that in the case of the Danzig Corridor, the Polish Corridor, he wrote a treaty in which he offered to allow them to keep that, even though it was largely German and it had belonged to Germany before the war. And it was very disadvantageous for the ethnic Germans in that corridor to remain with Poland instead of coming back to Germany. But he offered it for the sake of peace. But the other thing is that these territories that were taken, whether in Poland or in Czechoslovakia, these people were extremely disadvantaged minorities. They were German people who'd been thrown into a foreign country suddenly and were extremely discriminated against. So he wasn't just trying to grab land back. He was trying to protect these people in these countries.
He was a human rights activist.
That's right.
All right, great, Margaret. Thanks for that information. All right, let's go to Joe in Arkansas. Joe, what do you have to say?
Yeah, Michael, I'm really glad that you've got the nerve to put these people on the air. This is interesting.
Okay.
And what I want to say is that now I'm not ready to say that I believe Hitler is a great guy all around, but I'd like to mention another way in which I think that he has got something of a bad rap, and that's his taste in art. You know, I understand that he considered modern art to be degenerate art, and he tried to get higher standards going in Germany at the time. And, you know, and I think it was right. You know, a lot of modernistic art, you know, just really took the skill and the meaning out of art, and it was degenerated art. You know, but Hitler has been really severely criticized for saying such things. And I once saw a book of the work of Nazi artists, and I wouldn't say they're all the best artists in the world or anything like that, but they were really trying hard to do a good job. And one of them, a guy named...
It was the Golden Age, I think.
Well, one of them, a guy named Werner Pienaar, he was really good, and if he wasn't a Nazi, I think he'd be known as one of the world's greatest all-time artists. So,
you know, Joe,
anyway, if you got any more comments on that, you know, I'd be happy to hear them.
It's kind of interesting, Joe. There's recently a book came out commenting on the fact that art and architecture were very much a foundation of Hitler's worldview and what he was trying to accomplish in Germany. And that really was indeed part of the whole, not just the cultural reconstruction of Germany, but part of the whole economic force as well. So, an interesting point. Margaret, did you want to comment on that?
Oh, sure. Well, one thing, a comment on what you just said about the importance of art to his whole vision. He had that program called Kraft durch Freude, Strength Through Joy, in which he was trying to make the lives of workers better, both on the job and off, help them have not just be drudging to live, but be able to have a lot of the enjoyments of life. And one really important thing of that was having access to culture for people who couldn't afford it before. You know how expensive opera tickets can be. He made these things affordable so people could go to symphonies and to operas and to art galleries and to, and they could enjoy the things that expressed the human need to be part of something larger.
What was interesting, I think, about Hitler is that he integrated so much of all of these diverse things into his overall program, and it is that program that we never hear about. We only hear about, quote-unquote, the Holocaust. Well, let's go to Joe Fields from California, whom both you and John DeNugent know quite well. Joe,
oh, yes.
Come on up.
Oh, my, Mike, you people are saying nice things about Hitler. Can you believe it? I've been criticized over the years for being a little too pro Adolf Hitler, and the thing is, what you're covering tonight really needs to be covered. The economic program, I think, may be the key to why he is so hated today by the usual enemies. Now he was an example. His economic program in Germany was an example also for the rest of Europe. There were many movements across Europe in the 30s. As a matter of fact, in America, we had Dr. Townsend and Huey Long, Father Coughlin, who were also advocating a system, an economic system that was free of usury and free of the international bankers. And what you're touching on tonight is an issue that more people need to talk about. And it's, what did Hitler do in order to get Germany on its feet economically overnight? And I think, Margaret, you and John are doing a great job tonight getting that across to the people.
Joe, thanks for your call. I appreciate that. Yeah, I knew this was going to be an interesting show, and I can see by the response that people were learning a lot here tonight. Let's go. We have a caller from Ireland. Mike, calling from Ireland.
Hello.
Hello,
Mike.
I have to agree with Joe. I really have to agree with Joe. I moved from Chicago, and I moved over to Ireland because of economic reasons specifically. And I'm a great studier of history. And one of the things that I found after moving to the European Union is that the European Union now has been modeled after what the Third Reich specifically decided that it wanted to do with Europe in World War II. However, it was going to exclude specific individuals like the bankers that we all hate. You agree, mm-hmm. Margaret?
That's right, yes. Yes, there are some bad things in the European Union, unfortunately, that kind of vitiate the intention that Hitler had for Europe.
It shines every day, specifically today in Ireland. You know, they're at, it's the most expensive country in Europe. However, it has the lowest mortgage rates and lowest borrowing rates. The average Irishman today has borrowed 135% the value of his home.
Oh, wow, that's interesting.
So there's a different concept that's come across here. You know, this is a country. I'm living in a country now. My family's from here. It was basically a third world country 15 years ago, and now it's an economic power when it comes to a couple of select industries specifically. However, flip side of the coin, they're borrowing money that they can't pay back if there's an economic collapse for any reason.
It's a time bomb
that's waiting to happen. It's a slow but sure thing.
Yes, you see this all the time. You saw this in America at the time of the Depression. You saw this in Germany after World War One. They create these cycles, and they end up grabbing all the money, like the owners of the gambling house, where it's always planted towards the house. Eventually, they'll get it all.
And those casinos are all owned by the Rothschilds and their financial satellites, both in Europe and in the United States.
And on Indian reservations, too.
That's exactly right.
Here's a question for you. Completely speculative. In the event the Third Reich did not declare war on the United States, more than likely, I assume that they probably would have remained sovereign.
Would have what?
They would have remained as a sovereign entity. Now, over the course of the next 60 years, where we are now, you think the bankers would have got their grip in them?
Would have gotten...
gotten their grip into the,
oh,
the society.
Well, first
that
of all,
developed.
It would have made no difference if Adolf Hitler had not declared war on the U.S. because Pearl Harbor accomplished that already. Roosevelt made it very clear to the Congress that he was going in to Germany. That was the purpose of it. It was a backdoor into fighting Germany because he considered them as an ally of the Japanese, and that was the whole point of the exercise. Hitler went ahead and declared war for a few reasons, one of which was that it allowed his people who were constantly being attacked by United States vessels and stuff by order of Roosevelt, it allowed them to fight back because he was pretty punctilious about matters of war and he was trying not to escalate things. But once he declared war, There were some other reasons I don't remember, but whatever it was.
It was an inevitability is basically what it comes down to.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, Mike, I appreciate your call. We still have quite a few callers lined up here. I want to try to get them all in. Let's go to Gene in Texas. Gene, come on up.
Most of the people that died in these camps died after the Allied bombed the supply routes to these camps in 1944. And nobody was deliberately... really killed. They died of starvation and of illness because of that. Number two, Germany, of course, was in a great bigger depression than we were, even before the USA was. And most of the money was in the hand of the nominal Jew communist. And in fact, they declared war on Germany in the early 30s by saying they were going to boycott all German businesses so they basically declared an economic war on Germany in the early 30s when the Nazi Party first took over.
That's right. It sort of backfired.
What, ma'am?
We sort of backfired.
Yeah. And also in 1938, Chamberlain and Hitler agreed to a Munich Pact. And in that Munich Pact, Chamberlain came back to London and said that they had agreed never to go to war with each other, no matter what, that they were going to try to work out any problems through negotiations. And when England declared war on Germany because of Germany taking over Poland to kick out the nominal Jew communists there that were running that country and freeing the German people from nominal Jew communist slavery there, England declared war on Germany for doing that in violation of the Munich Pact, totally. There was no negotiation. England just said, we're going to declare war on Germany in violation of that Munich Pact just 2 years earlier. And I'd like to have your comment on that.
Well, when Chamberlain came home, same as with Daladier in France, who came back from the Munich conference, they were met by people at the airport, people of the country who were very, very strongly in favor of what they had just done, because, of course, people want peace. But there were the war clan in each country, which immediately took very strong steps to turn that around, because it's exactly what they didn't want to happen, was to have war put off for the foreseeable future. So Churchill and the rest of the warmongers in England went to work very strongly against Chamberlain. And I wonder, I just recently started thinking about how sick Chamberlain was around that time, and it's not at all out of the question that that wasn't an accident that he was so sick, because he was unable to protect his stand.
You know, Margaret, it's kind of interesting. David Irving, in his book, Churchill's War, Volume 1, of course, David Irving's in jail in Austria for, quote-unquote, denying the Holocaust. But in any case, David Irving pointed out that Churchill had actually been compromised financially by Jewish bankers in Britain who paid off all his substantial debt. Churchill was in the Churchill was in the pocket of the banker. Gene, I want to thank you for your call. Yep. Let's go to another caller from Texas, Eric. Eric, come on up. Eric, are you there? I think we may have lost Eric, but we do have Ron from Oklahoma. Ron, are you there?
I am.
Ron?
Ron, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, go ahead, Ron.
Oh, what a fantastic program, Michael. You just never cease to amaze me. Every time I think that you couldn't be better. This has been so long in coming, and I don't know, I came in late, so I'm not sure who this lady is, but man, you've got to have this person on more, a lot more. There's so much to be covered, and she is the first person I've heard, outside of university professors who are revisionists, who actually has a clue about what has happened, and
Ron, this is Margaret Huffstickler from the Barnes Review.
Oh,
hey,
wonderful.
Folks, Ron,
thank you
can
very
stay,
much,
on, stay on, stay on for the break if you'd like, Ron.
Yeah, because I've got a couple questions.
Michael Collins Piper here with Margaret Huffstickler and John DeNugent. Interesting hour. It's a show that I've wanted to do for a long time, and we finally got the right person to lay it all out for us in a very articulate manner. Margaret Huffstickler, joined by John DeNugent. Ron from Oklahoma is still with us, and he has a couple questions here to wrap up the hour. Ron, go ahead.
Yeah, can you get these folks back on?
Oh, they will be back on. You don't need to worry about that.
Okay, I've been waiting for years for people to actually bring this kind of stuff out into the light. You know, the fact is that now we have seen what happened to Germany and Hitler has also happened to Iraq, and we know exactly how it happened. And it's exactly the same program. When Hitler tried to take the country back from the people who were driving it right into the ground and who had, during the recession, because of the international Jewish money, they came in and bought up Germany for the pennies on the dollar and totally ruined the country. And finally, Hitler came along and National Socialism is no more really than a mirror image of Zionism. So he just turned it around and used the same successful tactics that the Jews had been using and countered them with it, and countered communism with the military side of it. And it was all self-defense. You know, communism and Zionism both preceded National Socialism. National Socialism was strictly a defensive reaction. And they so freaked out because once he broke their power, they knew that they had to do something disastrous to get rid of him. Otherwise, other people in the world would start following his lead. And that's why they needed England and especially the Jew-controlled United States then to declare war on Hitler. And
that's right.
But I'm not going to say anything that this lady doesn't already know, so I'm going to be more content just to listen to her.
All right,
one
Ron,
thing I wanted
that.
To say, a comparison, because I really think this is apt, is that this was a protection racket. This was and is protection racket by the big bankers. Hitler refused to pay his protection money, and you saw what happened to Germany. When people go against people who are running protection rackets, they don't just get murdered, because there are a lot of people who are willing to die. They make sure they're tortured and that they die some way that puts total horror into the soul of anyone who sees it. And that's what happened to Germany. There has never been such a post-war, well, Iraq's doing a pretty good job, but they let you know you will not only be killed, it's going to hurt a lot. And so that's how I see it, a protection racket that Hitler was trying to break.
And you know, Margaret, you know, I have to repeat myself here, but it bears repeating, and that is the fact that what we have talked about here tonight, I'd be willing to bet that never once before, let's put it this way, never once in the history of the American mass media, the big networks, the big newspapers, it's never been discussed at this length, in this detail, here on just this one brief hour on the Republic Broadcasting Network, as it's been discussed here.
Yes, that's the door they don't want you to look in, so they would rather no one even mentioned it. So I'm mentioning it. Look in that door and see what you see.
Yeah, it's Margaret, I want to thank you and John also for coming on the show tonight. I can tell by the reaction from the comments.